Well, my heart's already pretty full. Man, I could just kind of go home now, but I got some good things to say, so I'm not ready to go home yet. Hoping if you're feeling full, we're going to get overfilled. We'll just keep spilling it over. So what we're doing this spring is we're doing a series through 1 Corinthians chapter 15, which Paul talks about the resurrection of Jesus and then how that affects our future resurrection. And so this deals with questions of the afterlife is really where we've been talking the last few weeks. This whole question of what happens after we die was really brought home to me, well, many times, but particularly I remember when my daughter Emily was 3 years old. It was 3 years old when she first stood beside an open grave, and she watched as the coffin containing her great aunt Katie was lowered down into the earth. She was watching this, and then a few days later, I was putting her to bed, and she was wearing her cute little yellow pajamas, and she started a conversation with me, and she asked me a series of what, upon further reflection, I realized were brilliant questions. First of all, she said, "Dad, where is Aunt Katie now?" I said, "Well, Emily, Aunt Katie was a Christian. She loved Jesus. She is right now with Jesus." And when I said that, you could see there's kind of a sense of relief. She'd asked the question with a tone of curiosity, but also a tone of concern. And so she kind of felt relieved. And then I could see the wheels begin to turn a bit in her mind. And then her face began to look a little bit confused. And she said, "Okay, Daddy, but where is her body?" And I said, "Well, Emily, her body is in the big box that you saw. That's what we call a coffin, and was put into the ground, and the soil was put on top of it." And then I could see the wheels turning just a little bit more. And she asked another question. And if she had not been so earnest in asking it, if the moment had not been so serious, I literally would have fallen over in laughter. She said, "But Daddy, where is Katie's head?" I reminded her that Katie's head was with her body in the coffin in the ground. And then the wheels began to turn a little bit more. She was really confused because Emily knows something. She knows that Jesus died, that God raised Jesus from the dead, that he ascended to heaven, and he is presently in the presence of his Father. And so she began to think, and she said, "Okay, but Daddy, then where is Jesus' head?" I said, "Em, his head is with his body in heaven." Now, just track how she's thinking. Her confusion is perfectly understandable. And if you think about the questions, they're actually really brilliant questions. My daughter is a very smart girl, still is to this day. She implicitly understood something that many even adult Christians I meet do not understand. Namely, that to be human means to be body and soul. And so, if that's the case, then how can Katie be with Jesus if Katie's body is in the grave? How is that possible? And if Katie's somehow divided so that her body's in the ground and her soul is with Jesus, then she's divided. But then how come Jesus isn't divided like that? It's just all very confusing. When it comes to questions of life beyond the grave, human beings have always been filled with questions. Some of our questions come, like Emily's, out of curiosity. You know, what happens when we die? What will it be like? Other questions that we ask also arise, just like Emily, out of concern. Where are my loved ones? Will I ever see them again? And some of our questions arise out of sheer skepticism. You know, you can't scientifically prove that there's life after death, so how can we possibly know if there is anything after death? In the 15th chapter of Corinthians, Paul has been tackling many of these questions. He's already argued that, yes, there's life after death, that since God raised Jesus from the dead, he can and he will raise all those who belong to Christ from the dead. That's a future event still. But then, okay, now more questions come up. Okay, he's going to raise us from the dead. Now Paul deals with three other questions that come up concerning the future resurrection of the dead. This morning, first of all, we're going to ask, what does it mean to be raised? What do we mean by resurrection? Secondly, what will it be like to be raised? What is this body that we're talking about? What's that body like? And then finally, how will we be raised? First then, what does it mean to be raised. What do we mean by this term resurrection? Let's pick it up in verse 35. And as we pick it up, you remember that in this entire chapter, I've been telling you that there were some people in Corinth who were ridiculing this idea of resurrection. They could not accept it. So as we begin to read verse 35, the way you actually need to read the questions that Paul's going to say, you need to read them with kind of a mocking tone, a ridiculing tone. So this is how you read verse 35. But someone will ask, how are the dead raised? I mean, come on, Paul. I mean, how is that possible? What if a bomb obliterates a person's body and the dust is scattered to the four corners of the earth? How could it be possible that their body could be raised? Second question. With what kind of body do they come? That's how you read that. That's right in there in the Greek. That's there. The person say, come on. I mean, are we imagining like a bunch of zombies walking around? Is that what we're talking about? Are you saying like body parts are going to come flying up and stitch together so we're all kind of just like Frankensteins walking around? With what kind of body? That's impossible. That's what's going on in verse 35. So these questions are designed to ridicule the whole idea of a future resurrection of the dead. You see, these ancient people in Corinth, like many people today, do not believe in resurrection. They believed in life after death, like many do today, but they did not believe in resurrection. So let's clarify here, what do we mean when he's talking about being raised? What do we mean by resurrection? If you ask most people today, even in the church, people use resurrection as synonymous with just life after death. But that is not what it means. Resurrection means a new bodily existence after bodily death. Resurrection means a new bodily existence after bodily death. Now, let me explain this to you, because I think a lot of Christians I talk to are very confused on this. Nobody in the ancient world believed in resurrection, as I just said. Everybody basically, well, not everybody, most people, just like today, followed a famous philosopher named Plato. And Plato taught that the real you is your soul. Your body, Plato said, is a prison house for the soul, and that when you die, your soul, which is immortal, is liberated, is freed from this prison of the body, and it goes to a happy place. And so just like today, I think if you ask the average person out on the street, you know, what happens when you die? Most people are going to say, some part of me, you can call it a soul or whatever you want to call it, a spirit, some part of me will survive. My body will die, but this real me, the essence of me, if you will go on to some sort of a happy place. Now, I hear a lot of Christians talking like that as well. I hear it a lot at funerals. Sally, the real Sally, is not here. This body that's laying here is just a shell. The real Sally is now with God in heaven. She's left the body, and now she's with God. The real Sally is in God's presence. So let's comfort ourselves by that. Now, I know what people are trying to say, and in a moment I'm going to show you, I think it's partly true, but what I want to show you in this very first point is that that misses the core of what the Bible teaches about what it means to be human, and it fails to grasp what the great hope of the entire Bible is. So it downplays what the great hope of the Bible is, though it does offer some hope. So let me put it to you like this. When we get into the Bible, what we learn is that in Genesis chapters 1 and 2, what it means to be human is to be body and soul. God did not just create a bunch of spirits on the earth to float around. He made Adam and Eve. He made them physical. He gave them bodies, and he breathed into Adam the breath of life. So to be human is to be body and soul. The real you is body and soul. To be human is to be an embodied soul. That's how you can summarize what it means to be human, an embodied soul. So what happens at death then? At death, the soul does leave the body. So the real you gets split. Your soul goes to be with God if you're a Christian. Your body is defeated by death and goes into the ground. So the Bible says that when, and this is what people mean at funerals, this is what I think they're getting at, though this is the proper part. When a Christian dies, their soul goes immediately to be with God. So for instance, Jesus on the cross says to the repentant thief beside him, "Today you will be with me in paradise." Paul says to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. So the soul then does immediately go to be with God. But listen carefully. This is going to come as a shock maybe to many of you, though this is just strict Orthodox Christian teaching. It always has been. I've chosen my words very carefully here. The great hope of Christianity is not to die and have your soul leave this earth and go and live in a spiritual place called heaven. I'll say it again. The great hope, that's the careful words, the great hope of Christianity is not to die and have your soul leave this earth and go and live as a disembodied spirit or soul in heaven forever. That's not the great hope of Christianity. That is indeed what happens at death. But the Bible very clearly teaches that this is a temporary state. In fact, we could say very accurately, it's an incomplete state. It's not that those in heaven aren't filled with joy right now, but they are in an incomplete state. In fact, if you go looking through the Bible, what happens after death, you don't find very much. The verses I quoted to you almost summarize what happens right after you die if you're a believer. There's not much more on it. The huge bulk of the rest of the New Testament teaching is about something else. So listen, the great hope of Christianity is not dying and having your soul go live as a disembodied soul in heaven forever, leaving this earth. Let me put it positively. The great hope of Christianity revolves around the second coming of Jesus Christ. The second coming is everywhere in Scripture. And what happens at the second coming is the great hope of Christianity. And the great hope of what happens at the second coming is that God is going to raise all of his people from the dead, just like he raised Jesus from the dead, reuniting their souls and their newly formed bodies, as we're going to talk about later on, so that they are whole, they are complete, they are everything they are meant to be as a human being. God will then not whisk us off to some future spiritual heaven where we live as disembodied spirits. No, no, no. The Bible teaches that God is going to recreate this earth. We are made for the earth. He's going to put us on a newly made earth. And then we read that heaven, the space where God dwells, is going to come down to earth. And God is going to dwell with his people forever on the new earth. I wonder if that's new for some of you. So here's how you need to think about it. When you stand beside the grave of a Christian, you should on the one hand be saying to yourself how wonderful it is that his or her soul is presently with God. You should feel that sense of joy. But then you should also feel a sense of incompleteness. Death has defeated their body. Right at this moment, death still has some measure of victory. Oh yes, Jesus conquered death at the cross. Death is a defeated enemy, but death is not a vanquished enemy yet. If it was, we wouldn't die. One day, death will be ultimately vanquished, but not yet. A defeated enemy, not yet a vanquished enemy. So God then, the great promise, the great hope of the Bible, is that one day God will not allow sin, Satan, or death to have even one victory over his people. Listen to this hope. God is going to rescue his people, and he's going to rescue all of them, body and soul. He's not out to just rescue part of you. He's going to rescue all of you. He will not allow one single defeat to happen to his people. So as you stand beside that grave, on the one hand, you're thinking, wonderful, their soul is with God. On the other hand, your mind should be looking forward to a future day, namely the second coming of Christ. That is the great hope. Read the New Testament. That's where all the material goes. And it's filled with this. It's all about that future day when Jesus returns, vanquishes death, raises the dead, and all the glorious things come to pass. So in a very real sense, those in heaven right now, though they have achieved part of their hope, have not received all of it. They do not have their resurrection bodies. They are not living on the new heavens and the new earth. They are still waiting in a sense as we are. We are all waiting for that great hope. That great hope that Jesus describes in John chapter 5, for instance, when he says, "A time is coming when all who are in their graves will hear his voice and come out." Does that not make you think of Lazarus? A day is coming when Jesus will shout to all the dead, "Come out!" And all will hear his voice and come out. And Jesus goes on to say, "Those who have done good will rise to live, and those who have done evil will rise to be condemned." On that day, then, that's when all the great hope comes to pass. As Steve's going to show us next week in this passage, on that day, then death will be defeated. And it's not until that day that the great saying comes true that death has been swallowed up into victory. It's true in principle right now because Christ has already won it for us through his resurrection, but it's not fully true until the day when Jesus defeats death and gives all of his people resurrection bodies. So our first question then is, what does it mean to be raised? And what we've seen here is that the great hope of Christianity is not to die and have your soul go off to a spiritual heaven and live as a disembodied spirit for all of eternity with God. The great hope of Christianity is that through Jesus Christ, God will give us a new bodily existence in a newly remade world. Now, as soon as we get that straight, and you know you've got it straight because now questions should come up in your mind. If we were just going to live in a disembodied state forever, the whole next section wouldn't make any sense. So you know you're on track if now you're asking questions like, "Oh, okay, what will that be like? I mean, what will that body be like?" Because the body is very, very important. It's not a disembodied state. It's an embodied state. And now Paul's going to go on to answer some of those questions. So our second question then is this. What will it be like to be raised? What will it be like? What will this body be like? So the skeptic in verse 35 cannot believe that this would happen because he or she cannot believe what it would be like. So look at the second half of verse 35. With what kind of body do they come? And in response, Paul says in verse 36, "You foolish person." Now that's how we know we should read that sarcastically, the one before it, mockingly. Because Paul's not name-calling here. He's calling to mind the Old Testament idea of a fool. In the Old Testament, a fool is somebody who does not take God into account in their thinking. And Paul's saying, you're acting the fool here. When you ridicule like that and you say, how could that ever happen? That's impossible. Why not listen to Jesus? With God, all things are possible. So don't act the fool. But Paul is a gracious teacher. He throws out a quick rebuke, but then he spends the rest of his time patiently working us through what this will be like. He says that if you want to understand how God can do this and what this body will be like, you should look first of all at a seed. Look at verses 36 to 38. "What you sow does not come to life unless it dies. And what you sow is not the body that is to be, but a bare kernel, perhaps of wheat or of some other grain. But God gives it a body as he has chosen, and to each kind of seed its own body." Now, seeds are very unimpressive things. Nobody ever sits around and just adores seeds. Though I said that once in a sermon, and a guy who had a PhD in botany took me aside after, and he spent a good 10 minutes explaining to me that that's not the case, that seeds are really amazing, and yes, they're phenomenal. So I granted him his entire case. But just as the average person, if you're not a PhD botanist and you're looking at a seed, it's not a very impressive thing. But take that seed and bury it in the ground for a little bit, and then when properly watered and sunshine and all those types of things, it will transform its present body, if you want to call it that, into something that you've never even imagined. I mean, just think about a great oak tree. It begins with just a little seed, and then a few decades later, all of a sudden, you've got this majestic, powerful oak tree. Who could have imagined that through a burial, that little body could be transformed into an oak tree? It's astounding. If God can do this with seeds, Paul is saying, why would it be amazing to think he can do the same thing with your body? So right away now, we start to learn some things about what this future resurrection body will be like. First, there will be continuity between our present bodies and our resurrection bodies. In other words, in some way, they will be the same. Just like a seed, all the genetic potential for an oak tree is right there in the seed. In one sense, you can say the oak tree is the seed and the seed is the oak tree. You don't get an oak tree from a cauliflower seed. So what Paul is saying is the physical you of the present, your personality, who you are, in some way will exist in the future resurrection body. In other words, you're going to keep in some measure your individuality. You do not cease to exist. Which, of course, is very different from so many religions and spiritual paths nowadays, right? So many of them of Buddhism and, you know, West Coast spirituality and this kind of stuff are always kind of imagining, you know, they say, like, you're a raindrop and you're going down and eventually you're going to merge with the great sea and you'll become one with the divine and you'll lose yourself in nirvana and become one with all things. And it kind of sounds nice, but my response to that is, I don't want to be a raindrop. Like, I don't want to lose, like, my consciousness. I mean, it's the same thing as basically ceasing to exist. There's parts of me I don't like, but I do want to exist. Like, I don't want to cease to exist and just be merged into the divine. I don't want to be a raindrop that goes into the sea and becomes one with the great ocean of all things. I want to keep my individuality. And that's what this verse is saying to a certain sense is, you will be you. There is a continuity between this present life, your present body, and the future resurrection body. So even after his resurrection, his disciples could recognize Jesus. Could it be that millions of years into eternity, you'll be walking along, and all of a sudden you'll walk by someone and say, I know you. I remember you from way back. Hey, and let's sit down and let's reconnect. Why not? You will still be you in that sense of the word. But secondly, there will be discontinuity between our present bodies and our resurrection bodies. So they will be the same in one sense, but there's another sense in which they will not be the same. And this is the glory of this passage. Our present bodies are like seeds, but a seed is nothing compared to an oak tree, unless you're a PhD botanist. Apologies if there's any of you in here. For the average person, there is no comparison between an oak tree and the seed. Although it's still the same thing, it's been utterly transformed. And you know what? I think it's a failure to grasp this that causes so many Christians, like myself for so many years, and like my kids often ask, and so many people I talk to think that, I don't know if I want to be in heaven. Like, heaven doesn't sound all that exciting. And then you start to say, okay, it's a new heavens and new earth. It's not a disembodied spirit world. Okay, so we're getting closer to the biblical picture now. But still, I mean, isn't it going to kind of get boring after a while? Isn't that going to be the case? Well, in his famous book, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, Mark Twain portrays a Christian spinster named Miss Watson. And of course, the main characters are Tom Sawyer and his friend Huckleberry Finn. And Huck one day is explaining about Miss Watson and her talk about heaven to him. He says, she went on and told me all about the good place. She said all a body would have to do up there was to go around all day long with a harp and sing forever and ever. So I didn't think much of it. I asked her if she reckoned Tom Sawyer would go there, and she said, not by a considerable sight. And I was glad about that because I wanted him and me to be together. See, Miss Watson's portrayal of heaven was so boring to young Huck, he just didn't even want to do it. He didn't even want to go there. So same when my kids, they are often a question will ask, what's it going to be like? And I think this is the point where as Christians, it's perfectly fine to use a little sanctified imagination. And sanctified, I mean like informed by the text, but always ending with, we don't really know. So when my kids ask me, you know, what's it going to be like? It sounds like it's going to be boring. Dad, is it just going to be an endless church service? And I say, I hope not. I mean, Megan, I love your singing. I really do. But a week straight of it, I know. And me preaching for a week straight, good grief. I mean, like, as good as it could be, that's a lot. Even just for a week, that's going to be too much. If it's just constant forever and ever and ever. Oh, okay, when does this end? So when my kids ask me, I kind of say things like this. What's your favorite thing to do in all the world? So I ask you, as an adult, what's your favorite thing? Is it to, I don't know, hike up a mountain and see the view? Is it to watch a sunset? Do you love the thrill of sports? Do you love art? Do you love the sound of music and listening to great music? Do you love traveling? What is it that you love? Whatever all of that is, take everything and realize all it is a seed. And whatever the future new heavens and new earth will be like, they will not be less than this. That's what we can say for sure theologically. What it's going to be, I don't know. But why not start the launch pad? Why didn't Miss Watson start the launch pad with Huck? And why don't we, with our own minds and with our kids, start the launch pad with what's the greatest thing in this world? What's the greatest thing about this world? All of this world and its greatness. In the Bible, it's just a seed. And one day, it's going to be transformed into a giant oak tree. So whatever's going to be there, it's going to be even better than what we have here. That would have gotten Huck's attention. One commentator named Paul Beasley Murray writes this: "The life to come will not be a pale imitation of this life, but rather the new order of things will be more real and more vibrant. In the life to come, we shall not be maimed ghosts tapping out our pathetic messages at the behest of mediums. We shall be more alive than ever. So our future bodies will have continuity with this present one, but in some way they are going to be utterly transformed." So Anthony Hokema, he's a theologian, I love what he writes. Here's some sanctified imagination. He says, "The possibilities that now rise before us boggle our minds. Will there be better Beethovens on the new earth? Maybe that's you. Better Rembrandts, better Raphaels? Shall we read better poetry, better drama, and better prose? Will scientists continue to advance in technological achievement? Will geologists continue to dig out the treasures of the earth? And will architects continue to build imposing and attractive structures? Will there be exciting new adventures in space travel? Who knows? But what we can say is, whatever it's going to be this, and it's the glories of this earth multiplied exponentially. There will be discontinuity." But the skeptic's going to say, all right, next question. Does that mean that our future bodies, are they going to have the same kind of flesh like we have now, like flesh and bones? I mean, that kind of seems ridiculous. The Frankenstein thing, are we going to have stitched all together from our dead corpses and we're going to walk around like Frankenstein? Is that the kind of body we're going to have? In verse 39, Paul basically says, come on, people. You know what a silly statement that is? The God who created everything, he gives one kind of flesh to a fish. It suits its mode of existence. He gives another kind of flesh to a human being. It suits our mode of existence. So look at verse 39. "For not all flesh is the same, but there is one kind for humans, another for animals, another for birds, and another for fish." God is not locked into giving one type of body. He's creative. He can transform this present body to fit that future life. So the third thing then we learn about what this body will be like is this: whatever our resurrection body is like, it will be perfectly suited to our future mode of existence. The fourth thing we learn is that our resurrection bodies will have their own unique splendor. Paul now lifts our eyes up to the heavens to consider the splendor of the stars and the sun, how they differ from each other. Look at verses 40 to 41. "There are heavenly bodies and earthly bodies, but the glory of the heavenly is of one kind, and the glory of the earthly is of another. There is one glory of the sun, and another glory of the moon, and another glory of the stars, for star differs from star in glory." Your future resurrection body that you will be receiving from Jesus Christ will be glorious. It will be unique in its splendor. There's an English poet named George Herbert. He wrote a poem called The Temple. In the poem, he describes how death used to be like an executioner. But because of what Jesus has done through his death and through his resurrection, death has now been transformed into what he calls a gardener. And here's the line from his poem. An executioner at best, thou art a gardener now. Because of what Christ has done, you were an executioner, death. We could not escape you. But now through Christ's resurrection and his death, you have been transformed into a gardener. And what does a gardener do? A gardener plants a seed in the ground and, having done that, puts it on the path to be transformed into something much more glorious. So what he's saying is, Christian, you can look death in the face and say, death, do your worst to me. You will put me in the ground, but in putting me in the ground, you are only setting me up for that future transformation when God will raise me and transform my body. So do your worst, death. You're nothing but a gardener now. Paul now ties all this together in verse 42, saying, so it is with the resurrection of the dead. This has all been about that. And now he goes on to give some more characteristics of this future body. The fifth thing we learn is that our resurrection bodies will be imperishable. Look at verse 43, halfway through. It is sown in dishonor. Verse 42, yeah. It is with the resurrection of the dead. What is sown is perishable. What is raised is imperishable. Oh man, this is a good one, isn't it? And I think the older you get, the more glorious this verse becomes to you. Our bodies are falling apart. Getting old is not much fun. I think young people, we could kind of quickly pass over verses like this. And the older you get, as I talk to seniors, these verses become better and better and better. What hope that God will give us imperishable bodies. I mean, no more headaches or pneumonia. No more broken bones or pulled muscles. No more coughing and sneezing. No more cataracts. No more ulcers. No more back pain or arthritis. No more dementia or Alzheimer's. No more wheelchairs. No more walkers or canes, no more knee braces or pacemakers, no more anxiety attacks, no more mental illness, no more diabetes, no more osteoporosis, no more AIDS, no more heart attacks, no more strokes, no more cancer, no more death, imperishable. Yeah. Imperishable. And listen, Christian, God has won all of this for you through Jesus Christ. Jesus has secured all of this. It's already yours. All you have to do is walk through death, and when he comes, it's all yours. It's not that this is some wishful thing. We hope he gives it to us one day. No, this is rock solid hope bought for you through the blood of Christ, and one day it's all yours. Sixth, our resurrection bodies will be glorious. Verse 43, it is sown in dishonor, it is raised in glory. This body we have right now, when it dies, we cover it up, don't we? We put on makeup on it, we put it under dimmed lights, we put flowers around it. We can't keep it out too long, lest the odor come along. But the resurrection body is going to be glorious. Listen carefully. If you could see your future self in your resurrection body, that body, that person is so glorious that you right now would be tempted to bow down and worship. That's how glorious that future body, that future self of yours will be. Seventh, our resurrection bodies will be raised in power. Look at the second half of verse 43. It is sown in weakness, it is raised in power. Power and strength. Isn't that something the older we get, the more we long for? I mean, it was the Greeks, of course, who gave us all these statues, these naked statues of perfectly proportioned human beings. They love power, they love strength in the human form. But of course, who of us look like the great statue of David or something like that? Not many. You might for a tiny little bit for a couple years, and then it's going to be gone. Hate to tell you that if you're in your 20s, you're in the gym all the time, enjoy it. Well, you got it. I mean, how many of you struggle with chronic pain, with chronic illness, chronic disease? Your body will be raised in power. I am so grateful for all of you who serve in the medical field, but I can hardly wait until you're out of a job. You know, I might still have a job in the new heavens and new earth, but you're going to be unemployed. You can come to my house. I'll have you over. Finally, our resurrection bodies will be supernatural. Verse 44. It is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. If there is a natural body, there is also a spiritual body. Now, this verse can be very misleading. It almost seems to go against everything that I said to you at the beginning with this word spiritual. What's so difficult about this for translators is there's no word that captures this. Spiritual is probably the best word, but what it's talking about is the life the Spirit gives. It's not imagining some sort of disembodied existence, because that would go against everything Paul's talking about. What he means is supernatural. It's the natural body that we have right now. It's perfectly suited for this life, for this mode of existence. But as Steve's going to show us next week too in our text, this body cannot live in the glorious new heavens and new earth. It could not do it, like you could not survive on Jupiter with its gravity. Whatever that future world's going to be, it is so glorious, so powerful, that this flesh and blood could not be there. So we need to be transformed, and he says, we will have this spiritual body, that is, a body equipped for that future age, a body perfectly equipped for the new heavens and the new earth. So there you have it. Those 8 points give you a taste of what is to come and what a hope that is. Let's wrap it up now with our final question. We asked, what does it mean to be raised? What is resurrection? We asked, what will it be like to be raised? What's the body like? Now, finally, how will we be raised? And the skeptic in this passage, that's exactly what they're asking. How are the dead raised? I mean, that's crazy. But Paul writes that we will be raised through the power of Christ. As we look at this, Paul returns to his Adam and Christ analogy. If you've been here the last few weeks, he's been doing this. So let's just pick it up. I'll quickly walk you through it. Verse 45. Thus it is written, the first man, Adam, became a living being. The last Adam became a life-giving spirit. So we all entered into this state of life through Adam. But we will go through the next stage through Christ. Adam and Christ then represent two different bodies. They represent two modes of life. They represent the seed and the oak tree. But the sequence is very important. What's first? What comes first? Paul answers it. First of all, we have the body of Adam, which is from the dust. Then we are given resurrected bodies through the power of Christ that are perfectly suited for the age to come. Look at verses 46 and 7. But is not the spiritual that is first? If it helps you, just substitute, but is not the resurrection body that is first, but the natural, and then the spiritual or resurrection body. The first man was from the earth, a man of dust. The second man is from heaven. As was the man of dust, so also are those who are of the dust. And as is the man of heaven, so also are those who are of heaven. So Christ's resurrection body then is the sample of what is to come, which is quite incredible. I mean, he was physical in one sense, but he was more than physical. That's the way you can think of it. We will not ever be less than physical, but we will be more than physical. I mean, he could somehow pass through walls. I want to do that. I don't know what that means. But he could eat, but he didn't have to eat. So he was physical, but more than physical. And what's so incredible is that he was not even glorified yet when he appeared to his apostles, his disciples. Revelation 1 verse 16 describes his future, or his glorified body, as shining like the sun in its strength. You want to know what that future world will be like? Imagine being able to stand before all the might and power of the sun, and that's what one person's body will be like. Shining like the sun in its strength. Power! Something so different from this present mode of existence. So friends, this is the hope. That's why I said at the beginning, this is the great hope that Christianity offers. We have a hope right now that when we die, if you're in the Lord, you go to be with the Lord. But the great hope is that through the death and resurrection of Jesus, a day is coming when God will raise all those who belong to him. He will bring them into a world where death will be utterly vanquished, into a new heavens and new earth where God will dwell with his people forever. And on that day, Philippians 3:21 says, he will transform our lowly bodies so that they will be like his glorious body. If you visit Independence Hall in Philadelphia, you'll discover nearby the grave of Benjamin Franklin. Listen to what is written on his epitaph. The body of B. Franklin, printer. Like the cover of an old book, its contents turned out and stripped of its lettering and gilding, lies here, food for worms. But this work shall not be lost, for it will, as he believed, appear once more in a new and more elegant edition, corrected and improved by the author. After Emily asked me all those wonderful questions, she ended by asking me, will we ever see Katie again? I said, yes, we will, Em. She said, when are we going to see her? I said, when Jesus returns. Our great hope, the thing we look most forward to, is the second coming of Jesus, for on that day, we will be reunited with her when he raises us all from the dead. Won't be that great? Won't that be a great day, Em? Yeah. And all that concern just melted away. All the comfort came in. And I tucked her into bed with the hope that comes from the good news of what God has done and will do for us through Jesus Christ. Let's pray.